Have you ever been shocked and surprised by joy? Have you ever found grace and gift crashing into your life and taking your breath away? Maybe your child was born and you saw yourself beholding a miracle. Maybe a friend struck by you during a difficult time and you saw how blessed you were to have them in your life. Maybe you were shocked to find someone wonderful and amazing falling in love with little old you. Have you ever been astonished and ambushed by grace, finding your heart lifted up into praise, joy, and thanksgiving? I hope you have. It's one way that we discover the life that's really life. On the other hand, have you ever felt hard done by? Thought that the world was denying you your rights, preventing you getting your legitimate dues? Why did he get that promotion, not me? Why is she getting the credit for the project? I did most of the work. Why won't someone notice just how special I am and make a fuss of me? Have you ever sensed you're not getting what you jolly well deserve? And found some bitterness, resentment building up in your heart? And if you dwelt on that feeling, did it help you live life to the full? Or did it trap your mind, stunt your soul, and make you smaller than you ought to be? In our first reading this morning, Naaman is someone who thinks that much is due to him. He's a success. A man of prowess and achievement. He's a general who's won battles for his nation and found favor from the king. But he has a problem, a painful and shameful problem. He suffers from leprosy. Now, Naaman is a man of action. When he hears that there might be a solution, he's someone who takes the situation into his own hands and goes to the king of Aram. For Naaman knows, or thinks he knows, that that's where the action lies. That's where solutions are discovered among the people at the top, the ones with money and power and connections. And so in a little bit of the story, which our lectionary rather unhelpfully omits, Naaman gets a letter from his boss, the king of Aram, a letter asking or telling the king of Israel to sort Naaman's problem. After all, surely a king can do this. Naaman arrives in Israel with the letter and with a shedload of money, expecting the king will fix him and he'll pay a decent price for the healing. But he's come to the wrong place and the wrong person. If he'd actually listened to the poor young female foreign slave, the outsider who gave him good news about a possible healing, if he'd listened to the person who really knew what was what, he'd have gone to find a prophet, not a palace. Well, fortunately, after nearly provoking a diplomatic incident, Naaman does end up at the right place. But he's still not very happy, because he doesn't think he's getting his due. He pitches up with his retinue, all his wealth, his massive entourage, but the prophet doesn't even come out to greet him. He just sends a message telling Naaman to wash in the Jordan, that tiny little brook running through Israel. Our general gets very grumpy. He expected a performance. For me, surely he would have come out, invoked his God in a loud voice, waved his hands around dramatically and done some visible healing. Naaman's upset. If all I have to do is wash in a river, well, frankly, I've got much better rivers back home. He's in the right mood. He hasn't got the attention, the spectacle he thought were his due. So he turns home, unhealed. Unhealed in his body. Unhealed in his mind, unhealed in his spirit. But fortunately, another voice from the margins comes to him. Again, it's the servants who seem to know more than the master. They perceive that you don't look a gift horse in the mouth. Perhaps having so little, they know that they wouldn't spurn anything they were offered, however tiny or unimpressive it might seem. Master, they soothingly explain, why not give it a try? It's not much, is it, just to have a little wash? We're all a bit smelly anyway after all these days in the saddle. Why not have a bath? Naaman is persuaded. He climbs down. He gets off his high horse. He has a wash in the lowly Jordan and finds that he's clean. Amended in mind and mood, he returns to Elisha, confessing faith in the God of Israel and offering his thanks and praise. Thanksgiving. I think that's the sign of the most profound kind of healing. And in our gospel, we find another foreign leper healed by the God of Israel. In this little story written by Luke, who by tradition is a doctor, a physician, we find that he uses very carefully three different words about the therapy that the 10 lepers receive. Jesus is encountering a large group from a distance, and they entreat him for his mercy. He sends them away to inspection by the local priests, and on the way they find that they're cleansed, made clean. This means that their symptoms have disappeared or diminished. The visible signs of leprosy have gone away, so that the priests can declare them clean and fit to return into society. It might be a permanent cure or just temporary relief. We don't know. But for now, at least, the signs of leprosy have gone. But one of the 10 senses that something deeper has happened to him. He has been healed. His body is restored, made good. The power and curse of the leprosy have been cast out completely. And he turns and dramatically demonstrates how much this means to him. He bows down before Jesus and worships him like God and offers his thanksgiving and praise. And Jesus says, "Get up." He raises him up. The word is the same used about resurrection. "Your faith has made you well," he declares. Or in a stronger translation, "Your faith has saved you." Saved you. The Samaritan has been cleansed, made ritually pure. He has been healed, his body restored to health. But vitally, he has been saved. His whole relationship to God has been mended and restored. And this flows out of the Samaritan's heart in worship and gratitude. I wonder, are we ever as thankful as that Samaritan? Are you and I as filled with gratitude as we could be? I know I'm not. And so I try to make thanksgiving a spiritual discipline in my prayer, especially if I'm feeling a bit moody. It's one of those times when the world's against me and the universe isn't giving me all of my due. I try to stop then and give thanks, count my blessings, rejoice in the gifts and graces I didn't deserve that God has generously placed along my way. And as I render my gratitude for God's kindness, I usually find it works. It changes things. It starts as a forced gratefulness, a bit like when you tell a 3-year-old that they must say thank you. Thank you, they say. It starts as a forced gratefulness, but it becomes a considered thanksgiving. As mind and mood are lifted into gratitude, and released into worship and praise. And if you think, you might do with a bit of training in thanksgiving, then rejoice because you've come to the right place. This is Eucharist, this thing that we're doing today. Eucharist, it means thanksgiving. Here we can train ourselves to thank God, to thank him for his word as we ponder it and gratefully take its message and grace into our lives. Here we can thank God for the fellowship he's baptized us into, the brothers and sisters he's granted us to love and to be loved by as we walk together in Jesus' way. Here we can thank God above all for Jesus, his life, his death, his resurrection, for offering us his healing presence and grace in this sacrament to come right into our bodies and into our lives. So why not find a particular thanksgiving to offer this day at the altar, to bring in your heart and offer to God as you come to him? And as you worship and bow down in praise and gratitude, listen out for those transforming words of Jesus speaking to you. Get up, go on your way. Your faith has saved you.